Hi, welcome to Musings with Monse, a podcast where I have meaningful conversations with all kinds of artists. Musicians, poets, photographers, and other creatives share their honest stories, touching on the duality of being creative, the pure joy of making art, but also the particular struggles that come with it.
And honey, there's no way that I'll ever know. Oh, everything about you, but oh, how I love what I do. And honey, I love what I don't know too.
In this episode, I am talking to my very dear friend, Antonique Smith. Antonique is an actress, a Grammy-nominated singer, and an activist. She is most known for her starring role as Faith Evans in the film Notorious and her leading role in Rent on Broadway as Mimi. She's currently working on a number of acting projects, and you can hear her on the new radio show on climate change from the Hip Hop Caucus called Think 100%. I always love talking to Antonique, and I hope you enjoy listening. And stay tuned. Who knows? We might do a part two of this conversation down the road. Antonique?
Hi.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. How you doing?
Good. So good to hear your voice.
Yeah. Good to hear yours too.
All right. So we're just going to get right into it. I want to hear a little bit about from your, in your own words, your story. You're an actress, you're a singer, you're an activist, and my dear friend.
Yes.
And if you could, you know, in your own words, just tell me a little bit about your story.
Well, yeah, I'm a girl from East Orange, New Jersey, you know, and I just was, come from a very loving family. My parents just celebrated 43 years of marriage. I have a little sister who has special needs, who is my favorite person on the planet. And so that, you know, was kind of the roots. And I heard Whitney Houston's voice as a little girl and just was became obsessed with wanting to sound like her. And so I sang. I thought I was good too. I couldn't sing as a kid. I couldn't have been on Star Search or nothing like that, but I thought I was good. And, I sang in church and my grandparents had I used to be in their living room and I had a tape recorder. I don't know who gave me the tape recorder, but somebody gave me a tape recorder and I would like create shows and voices and characters. And, you know, like I had my own little podcast. It was before podcasts. I was a kid. But it was like a radio show where I was the host and I was the guest. I would be men and women. I would be everybody, you know? So, that was where the character creation started. So between singing in church and just singing everywhere, and I would stop people in the mall and ask them to let me sing Mariah Carey for them. And people were nice because I know I've listened back to some things. I couldn't sing, so I guess people were just being sweet, like, oh, this sweet little girl, bless her heart. You know, I prayed actually in church one day when I was about 7 for God to like give me a voice, and he did. And so I guess I was around, you know, 11 or 12 when I actually started sounding good, and my parents were like, wait, she can sing. So you know, my dad took me to a studio and made my first little demo. And, you know, that's kind of where everything started to really start. And I thought for sure that singing was going to be what I did first. Like that was going to be my initial success. You know, I wanted to be like Diana Ross and Barbra Streisand, and they, you know, they sang first. And so it didn't quite go that way. I was singing, I was pursuing it. And an acting agent heard me singing in New York. And she approached me and said, do you have an agent? I want to represent you. Her name was Kim Matuka. I keep in touch with her now. She's a very sweet lady. But she believed in me without, I hadn't done anything professionally, like acting wise. That was something I always saw for the future, you know? So when she approached me, I said, okay, well, shoot. All right, let's do it. And she started sending me on acting jobs and I started booking acting jobs, you know, 100 Center Street. Cindy Lamette, who directed The Wiz, gave me my start.
Wow.
And I hadn't done anything professionally. Like, I just hadn't, you know, it was like I went from doing school plays and church plays to actually working professionally. And then I got the role of Rent on Broadway and ended up playing Mimi, and I became the poster girl. And you know? And so that really was like, once I was on Broadway, that really was like, okay. And I was actually singing and acting. I kept leaving Rent to go do music, and it just never panned out. And then I left Rent one year in 2007. I was just like, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I know I don't want to be here. Mm-hmm. You know, Broadway is people's dreams, but it wasn't necessarily my dream. Like, that wasn't like my ultimate goal in life. And it's a lot of work. It's 8 shows a week on Broadway.
I don't know how you did it. I ask you this every time.
So crazy. And we had the worst schedule. So like we would do a show on Thursday, on Friday, 2 Saturday, 2 Sunday, and then still have to do a show on Monday and Tuesday. So Wednesday was like, you're just dead. It's like, I had no social life. I pretty much was just recuperating just to do the show. I was crying real tears every night, which my father was like, please stop doing that, because he thought it was unhealthy. And it was good for the show, though. It really was, because you feel it more. But it was bad for, you know, like your body. You shouldn't be like that. You're not supposed to be feeling like that every day. So at some point, I left and I was like, you know what? I don't know what I'm going to do. This is a leap of faith. I'm just going to leave. And I didn't know what was going to happen. But 2 weeks later, I got the audition to play Faith Evans in the movie Notorious. So that was a 4-month fighting process to get that role. And I literally fought for that thing. And then when the movie came out, that became, you know, how a lot of people know me. And, you know, then I went back to just trying to pursue my music. And my manager thought it was like the perfect time at this point. His name is Daryl Farmer. And he was like, you know, I think this is the time. And, you know, the traditional route is what we started with. Like, we went to the labels. I had people say, you sing too good. You know, it's not, you know, like they had all these weird reasons why I wasn't, you know, right for being on their label. And so my manager was like, all right, well, let's do it ourselves. And he took the initiative. We did a Kickstarter, which I was scared to do. You know, it was his idea. And I was just like, Lord, I don't like asking people for money. But he was right. We this was early on, too. This was before people knew what Kickstarter was. And I became the first African-American solo artist to make over $50,000 in 30 days on Kickstarter.
Knowing you for many years, I've heard your story in bits and pieces, but hearing you talk about it in that continuous way, it kind of dawns on me what a manifester you are. Because even from a young age, you know, here you were saying like, please give me this voice. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine you not having the most beautiful voice on the planet. And for you saying that you didn't even have that when you were little, it's like, what? So that's awesome. And also, but it can be inspirational for people. Say, you know, people that listen are like, oh, I can't sing, but then, you know, they have hope.
Yeah, right.
Watching
American Idol definitely doesn't give people hope, man.
Seriously, did you ever try out for American Idol? I guess you didn't really need to, because you were already on your way. Yeah, you didn't need that. Yeah. But I love also, you know, just the fact that when you were little, you were sort of playing around with this acting part of yourself as well, and the desire to do that, and you manifested that. And then and also just your story about being on Rent, which, like you said, is, you know, being a lead character on Broadway is a dream of so many, but knowing that even though it's a big dream, it's not necessarily your own. And you were brave enough to walk away from that. And then look at how like the universe just threw you the next thing that was what really was aligned with your dream. And gosh, I love hearing those stories, because it's so profoundly resonates, you know, in my own life too. You know, when I've been brave enough to step away from something that inside I knew wasn't the right thing, even though from the outside it looked really shiny, you know, it's always led me on the right path.
You get caught up in things like that where, you know, because it is such a quote unquote great opportunity, and everybody, you know, on the outside is like, that's wow. And, you know, on the inside, you're like, but that's not what I want. So
exactly. Yeah. And you just trust that voice, and gosh, and then it's like, yeah. And then your life just meets you there, you know, and to the place where it gives you all the things you really, really do desire and want. So, so keep on doing it, girl.
Thank you. I will. It's been a blessed journey. Definitely unorthodox, but a blessing.
If we can kind of go back a little bit and talk about your time on Broadway, just because, you know, I think it does from the outside look so glamorous, you know, yeah. Oh yeah, I'm a Broadway star. And sort of just touching on what you were saying about it being really grueling physically and probably emotionally too. You were saying, you know, is it because you really put yourself into the role every night and you just felt it?
Because, you know, when you're doing that many shows, just like anything else, like driving, you could definitely drive and not really be thinking about it. Like your body goes into an autopilot where you're not as focused, especially if you're not driving really fast. Like if you're doing like 100 miles an hour, your brain is definitely focusing like super. But if you're doing your normal drive to work every day and it's just normal, you can definitely kind of zone out and be thinking about your grocery list, or you could be thinking about, you know, a conversation you had, and your brain is having a whole other thing going on while you're autopilot driving. Well, it could definitely be like that after 8 shows. After a while, 8 shows a week, you get into an autopilot where you're not thinking about the show. You're not thinking about the words. It's the same. I mean, it's the same thing every single show. Yeah. So you start to get so into a rhythm where you don't even have to think about it anymore. And that is honestly what most people do on Broadway. It's kind of like the, you know, you just, it's my day, you know, it's my thing. I go do my show and go home. And I fought that. And that was what made it more, honestly, it's what made it more work. But I fought that feeling. I did not want to feel like I was going through the motions. I felt like people were paying a lot of money to see the show, and I wanted them all to get the same show. And so on Broadway, we have our A show, we have our B show, we have our C show. You know, that's kind of, you know, how the effort. And most people do their B and C shows throughout the, you know, the time, because that's how you can, you know, do it without feeling like you're working so hard every day. And when the director comes to visit, everybody's doing their A show. When a famous person, when Janet Jackson's in the audience, everybody's doing their A show. But for the most part, everybody's doing their B and C show. When family comes, everybody's doing their A show. I tried to give my A show every night, which is a little crazy, honestly, based on, you know, this particular role. I was Mimi, and Mimi is emotional and vulnerable, but she's, you know, she's still, you know, badass and all of these things. But it was just like trying to recreate that vulnerability and that emotion and the brokenness that she felt at times was the challenge. And I sang hard too. I was adding notes and doing extra stuff vocally that I didn't need to do, but it made it more interesting. Honestly, it made it more interesting, I thought, and more fun for me. And I felt like I was exercising all of my gifts, you know, to the fullest. And so at some point, like when you first start the show, her journey makes you cry. You can feel her pain and the words and the songs, the melodies, everything makes you feel things. After a month or two of that same thing every day, it doesn't move you anymore at all. So that is definitely when most people aren't really being emotional. They're pretending. They're doing the fake cry, and, you know, and man, I was like, okay, how do I feel these feelings for real? How do I go there with the same stuff every night? So I decided, I don't know how, I don't remember how I initially decided it, but it was almost like I had some kind of emotional bottle. And in the morning, before I would go to the show, or in the afternoon, I would listen to the news. I would read the newspaper. I would try to find the saddest story of the day. And I would bottle it up in my little emotional bottle. And in the moment of the show, when I needed to cry, I would think about whatever that thing is. I would uncap that bottle and let that story come into my mind. And it would just flow. It was usually around the song "Without You." It was either around "Without You," or sometimes I would wait until the angel, when Angel dies, like that whole little "I'll cover you" moment. That's when I would just let it come out. And it was stuff like, I remember one time a little 14-year-old girl had went to a house party, and she got shot at a house party. And I thought to myself, when it was time to cry, I thought to myself, what her mother must feel like, knowing that she sent her kid to this house party thinking that she was just going to have a nice time and she never came home. Like, that had to be horrifying. So I could think of that horror at the time when I needed to cry, and it worked. I would think of, like, I think one time, the tsunami, that I thought that was one of the things, because so many people died. Katrina, I was able to think of, because so many people died. And, you know, I just would think of really sad things, really. And
oh,
I mean,
no wonder
honestly,
you were crying every night. My goodness.
But I needed something to help me get there. And honestly, the world, every single day, the world had given me enough reason to cry, which is sad in itself. I know.
Yeah.
So, so of course, you know, after doing that for a while, it is a little depressing. That's when my father wanted me to stop, because I started to get skinny a little bit.
Right.
But then she goes through a whole thing at the end where she almost dies. And so the director was like, the director came up to me one day and was like, okay, you are fantastic. You look, I mean, the everything you're doing for the show is fantastic. But are you okay? I'm worried about you because you look a little skinny. It's great for the show. And he kept wanting me to know, like, it is great for the show, but are you okay?
I'm worried about you.
And I was like, no, I'm good. Yeah. And I was like, no, I'm good. I'm good.
And was that sort of one your first indication to, in your body, that kind of tuning in and being like, okay, something's not quite right, that I'm not really feeling aligned right now?
Yeah, definitely wasn't the healthiest choice, but I did at the same time feel very proud that I was giving all that I could to the show, and to, you know, and to giving people the experience that they got from the show, because they were, you know, I was getting, people were writing me letters. Like, people were like, you know, your performance of Goodbye Love made me propose to my girlfriend, because I felt like if I don't do this, I'm going to lose her. And, you know, so I was getting these really sweet letters of, like, ways that it was like affecting people's lives. And so I felt like I had to keep doing it that way. But then, you know what, when I felt like I don't want to do that anymore, when I felt like I didn't want to give 100% and I didn't want to have to go through all of those experiences myself and for the show anymore, that's when I left.
Yep.
Instead of staying and going through the motions, I decided that's when it was time to go.
It's funny too, isn't it, how sometimes, like, there's this whisper that you get that you're like, oh, this isn't quite right, and it's not, and then you just, sometimes you just need to wait until that whisper is suddenly like shouting, and that's when you know it's time, you know? I don't know. That's just sort of the way I've always lived my life. It's just kind of like, okay, I'm paying attention to those whispers, and then at some point you're like, all right, now it's like gonna knock me off my head. Like, I know this is the time to do this next thing. And well, that's great. And then you went right into playing Faith Evans, as you mentioned. And fast forward to now, I want to talk a bunch about your advocacy work. But just before we get to that, right now you're currently, your latest thing is you're in Marvel's Luke Cage. Mm-hmm. And I want to note it's season 2, not season 1. Because I was watching season 1 and I'm like, where's Antonique? And I texted you.
And I was like, sis, I started episode 2. And she was like, I just watched episode 2. It's like, there's no way you watched episode 2 and didn't see me. I was like, are you sure you're watching season 2? She was like, oh, like, shoot.
Exactly. So, yes, so word to everybody listening. Please start with season.
Hilarious.
Well, I mean, you can obviously watch season 1, but if you're looking for Antonique, start in season 2. And yeah, well, why don't we just actually get right into your work as an advocate? You are a big time advocate, as I mentioned, for climate justice and human rights. And I know you were part of a 20 city Act on Climate tour. And I'd love for you to just talk about what that really means to you and expand on that a little bit.
Well, climate change and environmental justice go hand in hand. And what people, the perception about climate change for the most part, especially for a good half the country, is either that it doesn't exist, it's not real, or it does exist, but it's not really something that affects my life. And it's not like, you know, it's kind of a future problem, and it's a problem with ice glaciers and polar bears, and who cares about that? So that's kind of what most people feel. about climate change. So those, especially those who are uninformed. And like I said, that's definitely a good half the country, if not a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And so, but the truth is that not only is it a real problem that could jeopardize our entire existence, all of our existence on the planet, in not very long, in about between 10 and 15 years, like it could really be catastrophic. Like the superstorms that we're seeing are going to be like, you know, what do you call it when it just rain? Drizzles. It'll be like drizzling. Mm-hmm. The stuff we've been seeing will be like it was drizzling then. And that's how bad it's going to get. Like that Katrina was a drizzle and Superstorm Sandy was, you know, small. Mm-hmm. And so that is one issue, but also people don't know is people are affected right now. There's millions of people dying right now, mm-hmm. from the pollution that's causing the climate to change. Mm-hmm. So it's pollution that's causing climate change. And that very same pollution is also already killing people right now. You have, you know, people, kids growing up next to oil drilling sites right here in LA. Hollywood's all glamorous and you think, oh, Hollywood. But right here in Hollywood is kids growing up 200 feet away from oil drilling sites where people outside their window are working in hazmat suits, but they don't have hazmat suits on. And, you know, in Chicago, you got people living across the street, like a regular street, right across the street from a Koch Brothers plant, and they're getting this stuff on them, and the kids are getting leukemia. I met a kid who had leukemia, because he lives across the street from that plant. You have other people who live in food deserts who have to go miles just to get fresh food. And other, you know, they're living near incinerators. They're living near power plants. 60% of African Americans live within 30 miles of a power plant. And the emissions from power plants, all of these things are causing cancer, like high rates of cancer, high rates of asthma. Asthma is the number one reason why kids miss school in this country. You know, you got whole pockets of areas where they like to tell us, you know, cancer's hereditary, but how is a whole block of people who aren't related all have cancer? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's all really about greed is what we call profits over people, because the people who are able to dump this pollution and have things the way that they have it, and the oil companies and the power company, you know, they are making a lot of money, billions of dollars off of, you know, being able to have this pollution be where it is in people's homes, you know, in people's, you know, coming into their bodies. It's making people a lot of money. So that's why they don't want to make changes. That's why they don't want to move to clean energy, because there's ways that we could power everything without killing anybody. And, you know, but those ways in the minds of a lot of people who are making so much money off of oil and things like that and coal, they feel like they're going to take a loss. When honestly, clean energy will create so many more jobs and be so much more helpful to the environment, because it won't be causing climate change. It'll start to reverse the effects of climate change. It won't hurt people. People won't be dying from solar energy and wind farms. You know, these things would be helpful across the board, and it'll make people lots of money. It'll make people billions. But you know how people, when they're already doing something and they already got, mm-hmm. their investments in something, they're kind of setting their ways and their belief systems. So they're fighting. That's one of the battles. It's like we're fighting two battles. We're fighting for people to not be getting sick right now, and we're fighting for all of our existence on the planet in not really, mm-hmm. far away time. And so, I honestly feel like, you know, that's kind of like the most important thing I've been spending my time doing. I do it from, you know, kind of my art aspect. I think I like to call myself an artivist. I think using the arts, I mean, first of all, who's not touched by music? I mean, when you hear a song, it could take you back to a time, like it could take you back 10 years, and you can smell and feel and everything. A song can really transport you, or it could really touch you and move you. It could change your mind. So can, you know, film and television. You know, when you see, really riveting content, it can make, mm-hmm. you really think and change your belief system. And so that's why I like to try to use my music. You know, I did a song, two songs. One is by Marvin Gaye, and it talks about the problems. It's called Mercy, Mercy Me. And most people don't realize the words of the song, but it talks a lot about what's happening. And he wrote it 40 years ago. So I call him a prophet, because how did he know that we were going to be really going through it like that all these years later? And so I usually sing that first, because that's the problems. And then I sing a song by the Beatles called Here Comes the Sun. And I don't know if they meant to write a climate anthem, but the sun is one of the main solutions.
Well, and can you just talk a little bit about, just because I think it's worth noting, the different avenues that you have followed to be this activist that you are, and use your voice. I mentioned the 20 City Act on Climate tour that you did. And maybe can you just tell us a little bit about that and any other things that you've done?
Pretty much every city we went to had some toxic thing about it. You know, Chicago, I mean, we went to all kinds of toxic sites in Chicago, toxic sites in Baltimore, toxic sites in Detroit, toxic sites in, Los Angeles. L.A. was one of the stops on the tour, even though I live here, too. It was kind of crazy to be able to come here and see, like, right here up the street. It's crazy. So that was a big aspect of the tour, is going to these different toxic sites and getting to talk to the people who are suffering and living through this crazy, you know, this crazy life of going to the doctor all the time and not having the people who are polluting you. Now, the people who are hurting you aren't paying your doctor bills. Like, and these are not rich. These are people who are generally low income. Most of the pollution is dumped in either people of color's neighborhoods or poor people's neighborhoods. And when you're poor, you're barely getting by. You can't afford just to up and move because somebody has, you know, you find out that this pollution is making you sick. You barely now paying the bills to keep you healthy. So it's really like, it's really despicable. And it was tough to see. But at the same time, it was really great knowing that the work we're doing is bringing light to those people. And, you know, they also felt encouraged. It was almost like we were all uniting together, because that's what we got to do. I mean, that's the only way we're going to win and save lives, is to unite together and fight together, because it's the amount of voices. Voting is very important. You know, it without our voices being heard, if you just think about it at home and don't say anything, if you think, man, that's terrible, and you don't either vote, you don't go to rallies, you don't go to marches, you don't, and somehow you're not posting about it and somehow making the getting the word out or spreading it,
like for amplifying the voice.
If you're not amplifying the voice, nothing's going to change. Policy is a big part of it. Changing policy in Washington is a big part of what we have to do. And we all know that they're not going to listen if we're not screaming as loud as possible. Everybody should pick something that they're passionate about. But at the same time, also add in the climate, because that's every us being on this planet. Like, literally, you know, people think, you know, environmentalists are probably tree huggers and they're like, oh, Mother Earth and all these things. Yeah and no. Because for me, it's not so much about Mother Earth and the earth, the actual earth, because the earth is going to be fine. No matter what, the earth will keep spinning. It'll be here. It'll be fine. We won't be here. Right. So I'm being completely selfish in this climate change fight. It's about us. It's about human life on this planet. It is at jeopardy. We are in jeopardy of not being on this planet. Our existence is a jeopardy. So I think that is honestly something everybody should. So if you want to fight for, you know, whatever it is that's closest to you, also add that in, because nothing is more close than being on Earth.
Yeah, we have a long list of things that we need to be fighting for, you know.
Crazy, crazy times.
But I just appreciate everyone like you, who's using their voice, that, you know, you have a lot of people listening to your voice. So it's just great that you're using it for this good. So thank you. I want to talk about This is kind of a sad topic, but so Antonique and I had a mutual friend who took his life a couple years ago now. And I want to bring it up because I remember the morning that we found out. You and I got on the phone and we talked about the fact that both of us had struggled with depression ourselves.
Right.
And,
for sure.
And I realized in that moment, you know, something that neither of us had actually talked about before with each other, you know,
and or with Tommy. That's why we were all shocked. We were all shocked. It came out of nowhere. It was like, he seemed like the happiest person in the world, but so do you. You always seem like the happiest person in the world. And you said the same thing about me. And
about
it's like,
you
know, nobody's talking about their pain.
Well, that's it. Right. And I think that, I remember, you know, in my job, one of my previous jobs, I was meeting new people all the time. And I was working with, you know, all kinds of musicians. And I remember this one musician who I had worked with actually a couple times. And she said to me, you're just always so happy, aren't you? And I said, absolutely not. hell no. I think people like us who do have sort of this happy disposition, it's primarily because we feel a lot and we feel the highs. And so that comes across, like you see the excitement and the passion, but maybe what you don't see is that on the flip side of that, we're also feeling all the lows very deeply as well.
For sure. And that's the part where we don't talk about it. You kind of don't want nobody to know about
that's right.
You know?
And it's this internal pain that we keep quiet and we internalize. And I don't know about you, but after Tommy, you know, hearing that and then you and I having this conversation, it made me realize very, very clear that I don't ever want to hide that part of myself.
Especially from our friends.
Not because I'm saying I want sympathy or anything like that, but just because I want people to know that you're not alone, that this is something that we all, especially us artists and creative types, I think deal with and struggle with. And I think just you and I talking about that shared experience and knowing that we both have struggled with that. I don't know. It makes you feel a little bit more seen, you know?
It does. Yep. Seen, heard. It's actually getting worse in the world because of social media.
Absolutely.
You know, the fact that everybody's life on social media is generally not what their real life is. It's definitely not the bad, like nobody's posting the bad stuff. Nobody's really revealing. I mean, very rarely. I occasionally see somebody who will be transparent, but it's so rare. And for the most part,
it is.
You want to post your wins and the greatest things that are happening. And some people are straight up fabricating an entire life on social media.
Absolutely.
Like they're not living it remotely, but that's what they're trying to sell. And that's the climate that we live in. That's kind of how the world works now. And that therefore people are almost feeling like they're not supposed to have, you know, like something's wrong with them if they're depressed or feel down. Yeah.
And
so
it's
that's
like,
why
all of us are there. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. We have to be honest with each other, at least with our friends. Like,
exactly.
It hurts me that Tommy never felt like he always felt like he had to hide that part of him from me. But at the same time, I hid that part of me from him. So,
that's right.
You know.
Yeah. The social media piece, I really do. I see that I've always had anxiety. It's just been a constant companion, you know, in my life. But I see more and more people talking about their own anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And I just think that, you know, having social media be such a big part of all our lives now is just, you know, it's making it worse. And I remember, just to your point, I remember a couple of years ago, somebody at work, I had just come back from, you know, some music festival, I think, where I was, you know, interviewing artists all weekend. And I think that's when I came back into the office and somebody told me, oh man, like I was looking at all your posts and your life is just so perfect. And I was like, what? No, it's not. And that really hit me because it made me really pause and think, like, you know, yeah, I am sharing all this like fun things that I'm doing, but there's so much more to my story than that. Yeah, and, sure. And, you know, I'm not posting about when I was in the hospital because I had a really bad asthma attack or,
exactly.
You know, or the heartbreak that I just went through. And it's just made me more conscious to, you know, not necessarily like post every single part of me on social media, but to just be, try to be more real about that. Mm-hmm. Because it really like shook me a little bit when that woman said that to me, when she said your life is so perfect. And I just, yeah. Man, I was like, so not, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's crazy because everybody is so, we're all so very shocked when somebody like Anthony Bourdain kills himself, because it's like, wait a right. minute. He literally had everything we all want. I mean, who doesn't love food? He was traveling all over the world and eating the best food and meeting people. I mean, he had a relationship, like everything you think, money, fame, I mean, everything you would think a person would want. Kate Spade. I mean, so many people, Philip Seymour Hoffman. The list is pretty long of people who have recently killed themselves, who we all believe had the best life or the life we wanted. And man, it's not even necessarily about that. There's mental health is a major issue for human beings that we all take for granted. You could be completely depressed. Like, obviously, he was all around the world doing everything we all wanted to do, and he was still depressed.
That's right.
So clearly, there's definitely some kind of, you know, just missing link between, and it could be just he couldn't reveal it. I don't know if he couldn't reveal it to people. I don't know what it was, but.
Do you think, Anthony, about
my friends with, just, you know, people getting counseling, like counseling is cool. Like, we need to start making counseling cool. No, counseling is dope. Okay.
I talk about my therapist all the time. I'm like, so my therapist said this. I mean,
right.
all the time.
I mean, it's such a take care of your mind.
It's, you know, we kind of glamorize this whole self-care thing, like, taking bubble baths and, you know, doing yoga, but like therapy is a huge yoga, self-care.
Right. That's the self-care, and getting massages. Those are the self-cares only people, you know, glamorize, but it's also, you know, sometimes people need medicine and sometimes everybody needs somebody to talk to, a therapist.
Absolutely.
That needs to be, you know, amplified.
And okay, this is maybe simplifying a little bit what we're talking about, but I would love for you to share sort of what's in your toolkit, your personal toolkit when you are having a kind of bad day or you're feeling just melancholic, you know, and like, what are some of the tools that you pull from to try to get yourself out of a funk?
There's a few things. My little sister, I'd say for in my darkest times, dark times, it's my sister and my family that have literally kept me alive. Like, I think of my family, I think of my sister, she, bless her little heart, she's like literally like obsessed with me. When's Neek coming home? That's all she cares about. Cause when I go home, I don't stay in my own place. I, you know, we have slumber parties. It's me and my sister. She's 27, but because she's special needs, she's like a 5-year-old. So all she cares about is Disney Channel, Disney on Ice, and Aunt Neek. And so, you know,
that love
has definitely lifted me out of many dark places. And then on a day when it's not like dark, but just kind of like, I feel down. In-N-Out burger, I promise you, is my go-to guilty pleasure. Make me feel like, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the milkshake. I'm not sure what it is about that meal. But if I'm feeling down, I go get In-N-Out. It will lift me up. I have no idea why. And I'm sure everybody has that food. You know, some people.
Oh, yeah. Chocolate for me.
Chocolate. See? Yep.
I've been eating a little bit too much chocolate lately, but it's okay. You know what? I do the, I'm such a hippy dippy lady. So I do the whole cacao and just sweeten with coconut sugar. So I feel like it's actually good for me. You know, that, so I'm like, hey, I can eat a bar of chocolate.
Yeah.
No problem.
You're gonna have to make me some of that next time. I want that.
You got it. Like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And of course, the matcha lattes. You know how obsessed I am with those matchas.
Yes, the matcha lattes. So
I always drag you to whatever the coolest matcha bar is now.
No, great. And I wait for you to put sugar, because I drink matcha almost every day, but I do it, yeah, with, you know, no sugar or whatever. But I, with you, I do the lattes and I get some sugar in there.
You know, putting a little bit of honey in the matcha, like, sweetens it just a bit. And all those, you know, honey is so good for you. So it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to just talk about two more things. One is, you mentioned your sister being your favorite person, and I would love for you to talk about, it could be her or anyone else who has just been a very meaningful person in your life and, sort of a teacher or mentor to you in one way or the other. It could be, you know, professionally or personally.
Well, my sister, she teaches a lot about, like, just unconditional love. Like, she just, I don't know. I think because, like children, you know, they don't necessarily hold on to stuff. Like, stuff just, you know, like, so that aspect of being around her just kind of makes you want to just live in a sweet, happy place all the time, because that's how she generally wants. I mean, until you start trying to make her do something she don't want to do. But then at some point that goes right away too, and she's back to her happy place. So I've learned a lot, you know, emotionally and about love from my time with my sister. I don't know. I feel like I have a wonderful tribe, like, of people who just really love me and encourage me. I've been blessed to have people who have sacrificed, to help me get to where I am. For instance, to quickly go back to Hold Wait a Minute, my manager sacrificed. It is, you know, he put up the money. He actually produced the song. Like, he did everything. He marketed it and got me all the way to a Grammy nomination. And not everybody does that. Like, that's not something that, you know, that doesn't come just from everybody. Not everybody will make that kind of investment and sacrifice for you. My parents have been the same way, you know, as in investing their time and their love and a little bit of their money too. Not as much as my manager, but
I love your manager. I know him, and he's
he actually told me to tell you hi.
Oh, tell him hi back. Give him hugs.
I will. But yeah, so I've been blessed to have people in my life who've done these things for me and who've loved me and encouraged me. Because in this journey, it, like, just in entertainment in itself, and specifically acting, because when we music, you get no's, but it's not, it's like in the beginning is most of the no's, like right when you're trying to get that deal or whatever. That's where the big no's come from. But as an actor, every day is a no, because every audition is, you know, more than likely a no. Even the biggest, I had an acting teacher one time tell me, I think it was Bob Krakauer, said, you know, even at the very top level, they get no's because, you know, they have, people have to choose between whether we want Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise or Will Smith or Denzel Washington or, you know, those really top guys, they have to get chosen between two. So if Will Smith and Denzel both want that same movie, one of them is getting told no.
Mm-hmm.
So even they get no's. So imagine the people coming up and how, you know, how often you're getting told no, and that really can wear you down. And that's one of the things I tell people when people say, so I want to get into acting, you're like, what? Or people say, what advice do you have for people wanting to get into acting? It's like, man, listen, if there's anything else that you would enjoy doing, do that.
Yes.
Because there is so much no's and so much rejection, and it makes you feel bad about yourself. It lowers your self-worth and your sense of, you know, like, literally you start to take it on and literally not love yourself. You think something's wrong with you because you get so many no's all the time. It's par for the course. It's just how the industry is, how it works. And so you need people around you who love you, who are encouraging you, who are building you up every day, just to be able to go and face that aspect of your career every day. So I would tell him, like, man, if you feel like this is, there's nothing else that you would want to do in life but this, okay. Let me tell you, you need to pull a group of people around you who love the hell out of you. Because they're going to drag. Sometimes they're going to pull you along. Sometimes you're going to want to quit. And it's going to be the people who love you around you that are going to keep you going. So that's my advice to people. And I've been blessed to have people around me who've done that, who pulled me along.
Well, and I think just to your point too, is saying, you know, that being an artist of any kind, really, I think it's just something inside of you that you just know so strongly that it's like you have no other way, because it's just what's in you and it's screaming inside, like, that you want to be putting this art out there, whatever way that it, you know, looks like. Mm-hmm. And it's true. I think people that there are whole tons of people that go into acting or to music, you know, kind of for that glamour of it, not because it's really, really inside them. And yeah, I think just, you know, you have to want it that badly to be able to really.
You have to want it that bad. That is very true. Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's true. It's like that, those yeses that you do here must mean so much more to you.
They do.
Because you hear so many no's. Mm-hmm. And I think it's helpful for people to hear that, you know, even people like you who, you know, are beautiful in and out and so talented, you're hearing no all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nothing to do with you, who you are,
right,
or your work, you know, right. And it's just, that's kind of, you think about it.
Trying to remind yourself that it's not your self-worth. It has nothing to do with you, really, personally.
Yeah. And it's more like it's redirecting you to something else, you know, and it's hard. I think it's like, it takes a lot of life experience to really get to this point where you feel, you really feel that in your bones, you know, that, okay, like, I'm getting this no because there's another yes around the corner that's supposed to be for me.
Yes,
you know,
ma'am.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's something that, like, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I remember going to a job interview for my dream job and feeling so nervous. It's the dream job that I got that ended up allowing me to meet you. Mm. And I remember sitting there being so nervous because I wanted it so badly, but then I sort of just relaxed into it in that moment and said to myself, if it's meant to be, it's going to happen. And if I just need to be myself 100%. And if I'm not quote unquote chosen, it's because it wasn't the right thing for me. Right. And I was chosen being 100% myself.
Right.
And that was just sort of like a little nudge from the universe. It was like, okay, you know, this is the right thing. And I sort of have been trying to take that. I'm not perfect, but I've been trying to take that into all my interactions and choices, you know, even if, like, being on a date, you know, kind of just not putting so much pressure on it or you know, all the, like, everything, you know, just like, just being yourself. And if, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't choose you. It's because it wasn't meant for you.
Right. So self-love is very important.
Sure is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. okay. So I want to end by just going through sort of like a quick fire style round of asking you some of your favorite things.
All right. I'm bad on, I'm so bad on you know, like, off the top of my head with stuff.
Because you're like, I can't pick one. All right, it's okay. You can take your time.
Okay.
There's not like a timer, like, a here timer, saying you have to do it.
Don't no.
Okay. Like, I know. Okay, well, here we go. So, here we don't go, because I wanted to fix this one. All right, there we go. So tell me, because you were on Broadway, tell me your favorite play or show.
Oh, shoot. Well, it's got to be Rent.
That would be a good one.
Yeah. I'm biased.
Did live that.
I'm biased.
And how about Faith? And since you're an actress, you know, how about
that story?
Of course.
Shoot, there's been some other, like, classics that I've never been in that are like, oh my God, amazing.
West Side Story. I love that one so much.
I do too. And you know, Steven Spielberg's remaking that right now.
I did not know that. Really?
Oh, I can't wait to see that. But Rent. So I'll say Rent. Technically.
Okay, we'll go with Rent. How about your favorite movie?
My favorite movie, it's The Godfather. It's kind of a tie between The Godfather and The Color Purple. As a kid, I used to know every word in The Color Purple. I have no idea why, but I like memorized the whole movie. But I think The Godfathers are just a masterpiece. So that's why I say it's kind of a tie. But yeah, The Godfather.
Awesome. Okay. And okay, here's another tough one. Favorite song?
Actually, that took me a long time, but I know for sure my favorite song is Let It Be by the Beatles.
Oh, it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. You've sung that before, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Yeah, I remember hearing you sing that.
Yeah.
Beautiful as always. And how about your favorite place?
I think Six Flags.
I love it.
I love all that kind of like young fun stuff, like good, clean fun. I love laser tag. I love video games. I love all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Awesome. You
know, I know Disney World by heart. Like I don't even need a map.
Okay. And how about, do you have a favorite book?
I have to admit, I'm not much of a reader. I end up
That's
having
okay.
to read scripts all the time. And I read so slow. I've actually been working with Jim Quick, trying to get my brain to be better, my speed reading, you know, trying to get my memory and my speed reading up because I'm discouraged from reading because it makes me sleepy and it takes me so long. I'm discouraged from that. But I will say my favorite book is the Bible. I end up reading less. I'm not really much of a novel reader. Like I don't read, you know, yeah, I never read none of them 50 Shades of Grey and nothing like that. Like I'm not into
right.
the novel. I haven't Harry Potter, Twilight, none of them big books. I ain't read none of them, especially since they're so long. I see big book and I'm like, oh, heck no. But I want to read more. I end up mostly reading things that help you, like self-help and scripts. But the books that I read are mostly like, you know, different kind of...
Oh, I didn't know that about you. And I have, that's like my jam. I have so many. I'm going to start sending you recommendations. Just get ready, Antonique.
Yes. All right. I receive it. Yes. Send it.
Thank you so much for carving out time to do this with me.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll talk real soon. I can't wait to see you in person.
Yes. Let me know.
I'll text you.
Okay.
I will.
Love you.
I love you.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Musings with Monse, Artists and Their Honest Stories, is audio produced by the amazing Erin Mooring, and the beautiful theme music you hear is by Heather Maloney.